Welcome to the Fresh Fields Cross Borders with Confidence podcast series. It's our mission to provide clients with the intelligence and insight they need to make confident decisions in an environment where the stakes are higher than ever. In this series, we'll hear from our U.S. partners in conversation with their colleagues from around the world about critical issues facing global businesses today. Episode 2, Cross-Border M&A, from U.S., U.K., and German perspectives.
Hello, I'm Peter Lyons. I'm a corporate partner at Freshfields. I'm delighted to be here today with three of my partners. Starting far right, my partner Jennifer Bethlehem, a corporate partner in London. To my near right, Piers Pritchard-Jones, another corporate partner in London. And to my left, Rick Van Arsen, who's a corporate partner in Germany. What we're going to do today is talk about cross-border M&A in a presentation we call Crossing Borders with Confidence. We've set ourselves up here with a little hypothetical. Little hypothetical is we've got a U.S. acquirer. U.S. acquirer wants to buy in a stock-for-stock deal, it's a stock-for-stock deal, a cross-border transaction with a U.K. company or a German company. And what we're going to do is go through a few situations that come up, real world, ones that we've all dealt with, and what will happen, and try and explain to you how it's different in Europe than in the US. There are some similarities, but there are some significant differences, and if you haven't done it before, we're there to help you through this. So, well, that's our situation. Let's go back through it. Stock for stock deal, US acquirer, German or UK target. Now we'll go through a few scenarios. The first one will be diligence. But on all deals, it's a little different over in Europe. So we'll go through that for a little while. What happens if there's a leak? Happens all the time, but the consequences in Europe can be quite different in the US, and we'll go through that. Then how do you structure a deal? What are the considerations you use to do it? And then do you have a contract? You may not. Pretty surprising to a US buyer, but you may not. And if you do have one, what's it gonna say? So we'll start with diligence. So in the US, I'll just start to set the stage. Stock for stock deal, you'll have extensive diligence back and forth between the buyer and the target. And it's some extensive management meetings, a lot of information that flows back and forth. Is it the same, Jennifer, in the UK?
That's a really good question, Peter. And I would have to say it's not the same in the UK. And some of it comes from sort of market practice. But the real thing that's driving it is that there's rules in the UK which say that if you give information to one bidder, you have to give that information to every other prospective bidder that comes along. Whether that bidder is a hostile bidder, whether that bidder is the last person on earth that you'd want to give that information to, you have to. And that makes boards think twice before they open up their books to, you know, a bidder that they might actually quite welcome.
And what about Rick in Germany? Is it more like the UK? Is it more like the US?
It's a little bit like in the UK, where people are very hesitant to share that information because there is an equal treatment rule under the letter of the law. In addition, there is a corporate overlay because sharing information with bidders and not with your shareholders is technically speaking something where you need to have a very good excuse, as otherwise it may constitute a criminal offence. And that is why I would say it's a little bit more restricted even as opposed to the UK.
But, well, would you say that they're hesitant to do it, but can you get the UK target or the German target? If you're a US buyer, can you get them over the hump? Do you think that they'll ultimately do it, or do you think it's a non-starter? How would you?
I would say in the UK context, you can get them over the hump, but it sort of depends on what information that you're after. And there will be information which, in the US context, is really straightforward and you would expect on every deal, especially as I understand the way that, you know, the Delaware courts have gone, which is stuff like, you know, your forward-looking financial projections. And Peter, that's a context which in the UK context is quite different. UK companies, as a general rule, don't put out into the market as a general practice so much forward-looking information. And we have rules, and we're talking about a stock-for-stock situation here, which say that if we have to put out certain, you know, public documents in the UK in the context of that stock-for-stock situation, that those projections may have to be reported on by an accountant.
So maybe, appears. You can give us a little, what is that report like? I mean, and how often is it done?
Well, the report is a report commissioned by the target, by the target's accountants, and it has to effectively verify the forward-looking information. And of course, that can be difficult because this forward-looking information is internal to the company. It has been produced for that purpose. And it hasn't been prepared on the basis that it's going to be made public and have to be to a level that is publicly verifiable.
But when you say it's verified, what does that mean? Because yes, it's does it mean it is what it says it means, which is it's their internal forecast, or what is it? Does it mean something more than that?
It means that the accountants are satisfied that the forward-looking information is factually correct, i.e. the base on which it's been prepared is reasonable, and that therefore the output is correct as it can be. And that is a challenge because if you have projections that go out 1 year, 2 years, there are various assumptions, variables that can come in that may putting those sorts of statements out very difficult.
Now, in the exchange of projections in this in particular, does that happen, if it was a German deal, would that happen? It'd be commonplace in Germany or not?
At the end of the day, yes. So it's all a question of the getting over the hump, right, if I may use that phrase, which you used earlier, and people will exchange that information. I think what is important, however, from a jurist perspective, and we've seen that on many, many deals, is you need to get people quite a lot over the hump in order to get to a level playing field as far as the U.S. disclosure is concerned, because the granularity of the ongoing reporting of what's in the public domain is just, there's just so much more out there in the U.S. So from a jurist perspective, you need to put quite a lot of work in order to at least get to the same level on something that's in the public domain in the U.S. anyhow. And that is sometimes a little difficult for people to wrap their heads around. And specifically on the report, we have exactly the same issue. You know, the accountants, they will have a standard against which they need to do their work. It's about testing the premises, about making sure that this is all done in accordance with good accounting standards and reasonable assumptions, back testing everything. And it's just, I mean, at the end of the day, it's another work stream, which can get quite messy when there is a lot of things going on, and you just basically have to be aware of it right at the beginning that you may have a Pandora's box, which at the end of the day can derail some timelines.
And I think that's a key point, because for a US acquirer, they will need to understand that this is an issue for the UK or German target right from the outset. And the whole approach to diligence and the way that is set up needs to be done with this in mind. And I think this is one of the key differences in practice. And it's an area where we've seen transactions really stumble because of the different expectations between the US and Europe.
And that's in the context where, you know, especially if you're trying to do a friendly deal and you're trying to get the target to recommend, just going in and showing that you have a bit of insight into that just helps the dynamic and the general relationship between the two parties develop in a way that a bidder would want it to be.
Right.
So that, you know, the relationship is, you know, professional, cooperative, and, you know, sort of driving at a fair and reasonable outcome.
Well, at a little bit of cultural sensitivity is going to go a long way in terms of, because you're in the romance stage.
Yeah. Premise on the willingness to understand the other side.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's important for the European target to understand why the US acquirer is asking for this. Yeah. And you've talked about the Delaware law imperative behind this request, and both sides need to understand where the others are coming from.
So you, Jennifer, maybe you could build on the equality of information. In the U.S., if you've signed up a deal and then we have an interloper coming in, we will have some well-orchestrated rules upon which the target can give that information. There are no, so let's assume it's, take an extreme example, it's Peter Lyons Inc. that's making a competing bid. Do you have to give it even to someone like me, who on its face would not be a credible bidder?
Yes, that you do. And UK boards are very sensitive to that. And Piers and I have been in many discussions over the years with the Takeover Panel, which is the body that regulates takeovers in the UK, trying to get exemptions in certain situations for certain information. And it is really hard. That rule is sort of a sacrosanct principle, right, under the UK situation. So you can't assume that you. I don't know.
I agree. No,
because it will be easy.
Jennifer's absolutely right. The panel will be very wary about preventing effectively another bidder coming, right, onto the pitch. They will be sensitive to target shareholders saying, "Hang on, you've potentially deprived us of a very attractive offer." So the panel sets the bar for what is a credible bidder pretty low.
Pretty low. It's not so. Okay. Mm. So let's roll forward. So let's assume discussions are taking place. Perhaps negotiations are underway. Information is being exchanged. And lo and behold, let's just say someone, the CFO of either the bidder or the target, gets a call from your favorite reporter. The reporter comes in and has pretty good information, not 100%, but when the reporter goes through, as they usually do, okay, this is what we know, we'd like you to confirm or deny. Okay, in the US, CFO may decide not to, it's our policy not to comment on rumors, we're not gonna break that policy here. And oh, by the way, if a regulator, if the stock exchange calls up, typically would take that, would continue to hold that line unless and until things got really out of hand. Hmm. Now, let's start with in the UK. So same situation, same facts that I've laid out. What happens then?
Well, in the UK, the trigger for having to go public with what is actually going on is very low, and is basically regulated by the panel, who, if there is a market rumor, even if it is really incorrect, will expect you in a matter of minutes, unless you can persuade them that it's so far, you know, so fanciful and so far away from the facts, that you might be able to get away with not commenting. But if there is, I wouldn't even say 50% truth to the story,
wow,
if it's got any kind of legs on it at all, the panel will expect an announcement to be made to the market within minutes.
Yeah. The other thing I'd say is that the UK, and this comes as a surprise to many overseas acquirers, is quite a leaky market, certainly more than the US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you combine that with the low triggers that Jennifer's talked about, and that presents quite a few risks and challenges to a US acquirer thinking about a public deal in the UK.
Now, is Germany more similar to the US, the UK, somewhere in between?
I think it's somewhere in between, in all fairness. So number one, it's not as leaky as the UK, probably. And as far as the trigger point is concerned, it's higher. So for us, it's not like any leak or any rumor. It needs to be substantiated, and it needs to be substantiated to a degree that it would be unreasonable to assume that it's not a leak from your company or from within the inner circle of the deal team.
Right.
And then obviously the more substantiated it is, the more likely it is that you will be required by the regulator to go out and make an announcement.
So, and make an announcement quickly.
Quickly, yeah, immediately. Yeah.
So let's assume that
without undue delay.
Yeah.
To use a technical term.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. But so let's assume the announcement's gone out. Are there collateral consequences of the announcement being made? Does that put the target or the bidder under any compulsions?
Yes. I mean, it's bad enough having the deal leaked when you're not ready for it.
Right.
But in the UK, it starts what we call the pursuit period, which means that as soon as the deal has become public by the announcement in the market, a 28-day period starts running, under which the bidder either has to come forward with an offer or what we call shut up, go away. And the only way that period can be extended is with the target's and the panel's consent. And so if you're still in the early stages of romancing your target, and you haven't quite fallen for each other, you can imagine that that's probably the last thing you want as a bidder in that context.
So you either put up or shut up,
yes,
which my partners say to me early and often, but let's get past that. Let's get past that. But so that's happened. And if you don't So if you don't, if you say we're not proceeding?
And if you say you're not proceeding, then the panel will hold you to that and you'll be unable to proceed and you know, approach the target about an offer for 6 months after that date. So you have to be quite, you have to go in, I think, as a bidder from outside the UK, you have to be very aware of this point, you have to be aware that it may happen, and you have to have planned for it to make sure that your strategy basically doesn't get derailed by, you know, something extraneous to you know, you really.
Yeah.
And the philosophy behind all this is that target companies shouldn't be under siege for a prolonged period, because that is distracting for the business and therefore bad for shareholders. But you can see that it means that bidders have to be very well prepared and have to do a lot of work before they approach. However, in doing a lot of work, that inevitably increases the risk of a leak, and you're there. Yeah. The other thing it does, actually, is that although it's intended to limit the period in which the target's under siege, it can put pressure on the target as well. Mm. Because if you've got quite a well-prepared bidder and you are not a particularly well-prepared target, you have a very, very limited time in which to respond and mount a defence. So it's a very, very difficult rule to navigate if there's a leak at an early stage.
Well, okay. That sounds a little challenging, but let's assume the leak has occurred. We've gotten past that, and we're now sitting down and we're trying to put the deal together. And think about, as we structure the deal, how do we think about the considerations that'll go into the structure? So one of the questions I would say is, in the UK or in Germany, do you have defenses? In the US, there are structural defenses. We can put a poison pill in place. People have staggered boards, which can be used quite effectively by a target against an unsolicited bid. Do you have that in the UK?
Well, Peter, I know that you often refer to this thing as the sort of the target's toolkit.
Yeah.
We don't even have the box that's the toolkit.
Right.
There's absolutely nothing allowed. A target board is not allowed to do anything that could constitute frustrating action.
So it's standing there naked.
There's nothing that the board can do, and the panel will enforce that absolutely vigorously. And one thing that I would say about the way that the UK panel operates as a regulator is that when you go in to the UK market and you're not used to it, that it is a regulator that is another party to your deal. You will be speaking to that regulator daily. They will be directing what you are meant to do daily. So this is not a regulator that looks at the car crash and then tries to apportion blame. This is real life intervention as you go along.
With one hand on the steering
with
wheel.
With one hand on the steering wheel.
Yeah. Often two.
Hopefully two.
Well, yeah. Let's start, what about Germany?
We have, like many jurisdictions, a no frustration rule in the corporate law. If you are, you still need to run the company.
Right.
And so the way the board will approach this is, if there's something to be done and if it is within the ambit of a business judgment rule parameters, it can be done, like acquisitions, like divestments and what have you. So it's not like that you're in total paralysis whilst you're under siege, as you put it. However, there is a very significant level of scrutiny, and it depends on the risk appetite of the board, of the advisors, and what have you. But you can get away with stuff.
So you might be able,
but
to
not as much as in the U.S.
No, not. If I could think about this, it means that there are things you can think about doing that might have an impact on the transaction,
oh, yes,
on
absolutely.
The acquisition. But if you have other justifications for it, it's something
you need
can
something
at least...
that is outside and has no nexus whatsoever, and cannot even have a constructive nexus to the main transaction.
So in the UK, even your ordinary course business development activities, so I do a lot of work in the pharma sector, and any licensing deal, no matter how small, has to be looked at by the panel, and basically they aggregate all of these deals up And scrutinize all of them, and you will have discussions with them. So the target you have to understand is the bidder, that the target board is this is it's quite an oppressive situation that they're in, because you know every part of their sort of business functioning that could constitute frustrating action is under scrutiny by the panel, and will involve submissions to the panel and disclosures to the panel, which is, you know, can be quite painful.
And that all comes back to the fundamental principle which underlies all this in the UK, which is it's for the shareholders to decide the fate of the company, not the target board. So the target board can't be doing anything that could possibly frustrate a new offer or an attractive offer being made. And the panel sees itself as the guardian and the protector of shareholders' interests in this context.
Yeah, even, as you say, for a pharma company, which in the ordinary course might announce 4 licensing deals a month.
Exactly.
I mean, that would not be, it might not be unusual.
And large ones with large figures associated with that.
Okay, so let's one of the things in the U.S. we worry about is stockholder litigation. It used to be completely ubiquitous. It's now clearly very common, although it's not quite as bad as it was, but many deals get sued. Shareholder litigation in the UK?
Non-existent. In a transactional context. It's very rare outside of a transaction, although I think that is changing. There's more of a plaintiff bar developing, but it's in its early stage. Certainly not as nearly as developed as in the US.
Well, you got that on.
Yeah, exactly.
And the law, the corporate law, you know, it's not easy. You have to jump through a number of hoops before you can actually bring a claim against a director in the UK.
Exactly.
So that makes it more difficult and completely unheard of in a transaction.
In a transaction.
Now, Germany, there's some litigation, but it rises in different contexts. Do I have that right?
So basically, as far as in our structure the transaction is concerned, I, U.S. offeror, offer U.S. stock to you, German shareholders, that is something that is typically not being litigated.
Right.
It's a purchase contract between offeror and target shareholders. However, it can get quite messy. Then when you basically look at what we then refer to as the end game, I assume you make your minimum acceptance threshold, 75%, what have you, in order to fully integrate the German target, you need to have certain corporate reorganizations, which then, as a matter of corporate law, require a vote at the target shareholder assembly level. So you will have an AGM or an EGM, and there you have contestation suits and all kind of things where shareholders can try to block not the transaction as such, but the integration. And in that context, there's typically a lot of litigation and things are being held up. So planning your end game right from the beginning, solving for where do you want to end up as far as your acceptance thresholds are concerned, where do you want to end up as far as the integration is concerned, potentially squeezing out minorities and what have you, requires a lot of careful forward thinking, so to speak, in order to be clear as to where the litigation can arise and where then obviously value leakage may result.
So, but let's think about how the deal is structured to build on that, Rick. So in the US, it's pretty simple and straightforward. You get a topco, it forms a new company, it puts its shares down in the topco, does a merger into the target, and the shares are issued pursuant to the merger. Mm-hmm. It's a majority of the outstanding shares is the requisite vote. That's the way the overwhelming majority of deals in the U.S. are structured. So how do you structure, is there a comparable mechanism in the U.K.?
Yes, Peter, there is a comparable mechanism, although it is not a merger as you would do it in the U.S., but basically it is a court-sanctioned process whereby the members of the company, the shareholders, get to vote on the transaction, and if sufficient numbers of them do, which is 75% by value of those attending the meeting and a simple majority of those in number, approve the deal, then basically the bidder has acquired the target in a one-step binary process, which basically, you know, if the votes are passed, the deal's done. And if they don't get the votes, then the deal's down.
Now, you said it's a court-sanctioned process.
Yes.
Is that how rigorous is the court approval of that?
Well, there have been remarkably few contested court takeovers in the UK, and not one of them has actually succeeded. It is sanctioned by the court because the court is very interested to see that basically the way that the shareholders vote is that the shareholders are voting in blocks of people with similar interests.
Okay.
So if you are connected in some way as the bidder with one of the shareholders, then the court will see you as a different class and you will have to have a different meeting to sanction, you know, to pass that scheme. But if you comply with those kinds of steps, then the actual objections at the meeting are very rare, and not one of them has ever succeeded.
Okay, and what about in Germany? How would I structure my transaction in Germany?
Well, again, distinguish the takeover transaction, the offer transaction, from the end game. So the takeover offer as such will result in US Topco being the majority shareholder, 75% plus whatever shareholder, whatever the acceptance threshold was, and then you have minorities still in the target. And now German corporate law is then very, very clear on and very onerous on making sure that there is that nothing is being done to the detriment of the minority shareholders by the majority shareholder. So there is an independence for the board and all these kind of things, and therefore you need to sort of look at how you can fully integrate that target in spite of having the minority shareholders, potentially ultimately squeezing minority shareholders, which will require 95%, right. So you may need to buy some further shares, which will then have ramifications for your offer because there's price implications and what have you. So thinking through that endgame and how much integration you require in order to deliver on the synergies, on the whatever the equity story of the transaction is, will determine how important it is to and what the timing is of that last bit of that integration. But it can be quite protracted.
And are there examples of of deals where people try and hold up the back end, as you say?
Yes, I mean the back end. There are many, many transactions. As I said, whatever you do, in order to fully integrate, you have what we call a domination agreement, which will ultimately allow the shareholder to give directions to the board in the target.
So it's not as interesting as I was hoping. So
no. So, Peter, let me tell you something. It can be quite protracted. At the end of the day, yes, you'll be able to settle most of this.
Right. Yeah?
It's just another very onerous work stream.
It's just that
with some value leakage risk, which you need to sort of take into account beforehand.
Yeah. So let's turn to we've structured the deal. In the U.S., the parties would, before they announced the deal, enter into what we call a merger agreement because we're implementing a merger, oddly enough. Okay, but that tends to be a, as you guys have seen, 60, 70-page document with, a lot of heavily negotiated provisions. Do you have merger agreements in the U.K.?
We don't. In fact, as a result of some changes to the Takeover Code in 2011, we now are unable to impose any obligations, subject to some limited exceptions, on a target, which means that any agreement between a bidder and a target, which is typically called a cooperation agreement, is pretty skinny, 10 pages, and if anything, only really contains obligations on the bidder, for example, around antitrust remedies and risks, etc. So we don't have a merger agreement concept, and for a US acquirer, that is a significant difference between the UK and the US.
Yeah. So, but in Germany, you guys call it a business combination agreement?
It's effectively the same. It's typically referred to in the market as a business combination agreement. You would have, as far as the target is concerned, your usual standstill, non-solicit, no shop, depending on how the negotiations go, subject obviously to no frustration, equal treatment, and what have you. And then also obviously from the target's perspective, this is typically the key document where you sort of get the protective measures in for all your stakeholders. So you can show something for your employees, you can show something for your shareholders, headquarters, names, all the stuff that usually is of relevance from a target's perspective.
Okay,
so it's much, much more akin to what you guys
do. It's more similar to what we see in the States, whereas you guys have something completely different.
So the fiduciary outs and what have you will be más o menos like what you guys are doing.
The one that they seem to be similar. Now, in the U.S., in terms of conditions to the deal, you obviously have the requisite shareholder approvals. That's easy. You'll have the regulatory approvals, whatever they are. And then we will often have a number of other conditions. Those might include what we call material adverse change, that there's been no material adverse change. since some period of time. Now, that's a highly negotiated provision, and it's a standard that under Delaware law is quite high to get over. But we do have it, and it is something that has a lot of attention in a U.S. context. Now, do you guys have something like anything comparable to that in the U.K.?
We certainly do have something like comparable on paper, but nobody really bothers to spend very much time negotiating it, precisely because the UK panel, in decisions going back, you know, more than 15 years, have been very clear that MAC outs, it would have to be so severe and so pinpointed on the target itself for it to be effective, that most people, I think, would go into the UK in this context with, you know, thinking that the only two ways you could get out of your deal once you've made it was basically regulatory outs, or you need a shareholder approval that you just can't get.
But one thing you said is that the panel, so if I'm a bidder and, you know, the world's gone to hell in a handbasket and I want to invoke my MAC, do I have to go to the panel? And they say
the panel is the arbiter of whether a MAC can be invoked. Right. And there was a famous instance where WPP were bidding for a company called Tempus, and Tempus's business collapsed in the wake of 9/11.
Sure.
And WPP tried to invoke the MAC, the standard MAC that was in as a condition, and the panel said no. The target's business has been affected significantly, but it's not so significantly as to enable you to invoke a MAC. The test is almost legal frustration. So we always say to clients, if you're a bidder, you should assume that once you formally announce your offer, you are not going to be able to walk away, even if the business of the target deteriorates significantly. The only two instances are, as Jennifer says, shareholders not approving or a regulatory issue. Now, of course, one could always have a backdoor MAC if you have your shareholder vote late.
Yes.
And the panel is alive to that issue and recognizes that as a matter of law, there's nothing they can do about that.
Well, but what we do in the US to avoid that is to try and get the shareholder vote as soon, you try and, if you're the bidder, you try and pull it forward to take that off the table.
Yeah.
Can you have, let's take this example. We'll turn to Germany in a minute, but let's assume that you've got a long regulatory approval. Can you get the shareholder votes before you've cleared antitrust?
In theory, you could, but I think that most well-advised target boards would not want to go there. They will try very hard to have a shareholder vote at the end. And you have to always, even if you get an early shareholder vote, if something happens in the interim which would significantly change the basis on which the shareholders made that decision, you always have the risk that the board might argue that actually they need a revote because the basis on which the vote has been given in the first place is not valid in light of the new circumstances.
An early vote will take away that tactical ability, the backdoor MAC. But also, as Jennifer's saying, it puts a lot of pressure on your disclosure up front.
Yeah.
Because you've got to cater for a wide range of possibilities, regulatory outcomes, which may provide a pathway to the regulator that you don't want. It's not something that we see very often.
Yeah, that's interesting. So in Germany, do you guys have MACs?
Yeah, we have MACs. First of all, we don't need a shareholder vote, because as I said before, it's a transaction between the bidder and the target shareholders, and then they basically get those shares because we don't have those schemes. It's all in the end game. We do have the concept of a MAC. I think net-net, we typically end up where the UK ends up, but we don't have an arbiter. The way it works for us is that our regulator needs to be happy that the MAC is objective.
Right.
So you will get into a very detailed discussions as to whether it needs to be validated by expert opinions, whether there needs to be an additional trigger of an index going south very, very significantly, things like that. So as a substantive matter, it will typically not happen. Yes, there's a lot of, you know, wordsmithing and what have you, but net, as I said, once you put out your announcement, you're going to have to assume that the deal.
Well, this is one area where you get to a very similar outcome,
yeah.
Because in the UK, in the US, Delaware's never found a MAC to have been met. So I think we get this
one,
very high threshold. But we get there in very different rounds.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
It's very different rounds. So let's talk about regulatory for a minute. So let's assume we have a deal that has antitrust issues. There are two ways to deal with it. Typically, one, you may have a commitment to make remedies, and that can be what we call a hell or high water, which means anything and everything, could be with some quantification in it. The other way to do it is through break fees, and that means if you don't, if the deal doesn't get approved, the buyer pays the target, you know, a break fee. Let's talk about, you know, how often you see them. Maybe we'll start with the UK again. How often do you see those mechanisms? Are they common? Are there constraints on them? How do you, how do we do it?
Well, I'd say that in an increasingly regulatory interventionist environment, you are seeing a lot of targets who are very focused on mitigating against regulatory risk. And you're right, the two principal methods are a reverse break fee, and we've seen some quite significant ones where you've had US acquirers. For example, when we advised Wrexham on its acquisition by Ball, Ball agreed to pay a 7% break fee, which is the largest in the UK market. Secondly, you have commitments, hell or high water, or some lesser commitment, or a combination of the two. Where we have a often interesting discussion is if there are commitments, how should that be documented? Is there a way that it can be done which doesn't sell the pass to the regulator up front? But it's an area that that targets are increasingly focused on in the current environment.
And in Germany?
I think in Germany, exactly the same on the reverse break fees, as far as target break fees are concerned, where the UK is very, very strict, i.e. Zippo. I think we're much more, again, in the middle between you guys and you guys, Whereas, however, I would say that the amounts are not as significant.
So in the US,
typically speaking.
So in the US, you might say 3-ish percent would not be unusual. You would be lower than that.
Yeah, we'd be typically around the 1%. I think it would need to be very extraordinary circumstances, to go above 1%. Whereas, I mean, the UK is pretty clear now.
Yes, that's for the target to give a break fee. That's prohibited under UK law now.
So what we're talking about is a break fee where there's a topping bid.
Yes.
My deal doesn't get done, I'm the bidder.
Yes.
And I get, you know, and again, in the US, 3-ish percent in terms of, as you know, my consolation prize. It's actually not a very good one, but it's something.
There's no consolation.
No consolation, just
UK.
Tears.
So thanks again. We appreciate your tuning in. Thanks.
Stay tuned for our next episode, Auction Strategies, where Freshfields partners Matt Herman, Bruce Embley, and Arun Balasubramanian will give their advice for companies who find themselves on either side of an M&A auction process. For more information on how Freshfields can help your business, please visit our website at freshfields.com. Cross borders with confidence. Cross borders with Freshfields.